This podcast is brought to you by Money Control.
Hello and welcome to Money Control. This is Jerome Anthony and you're tuned into a special podcast where we are going to discuss the fine print of the Supreme Court verdict in the recent SR Steel case. I have a distinguished guest with me, Nilang Desai, partner at law firm AZB and Partners, and our very own deputy editor Deals, Ashwin Mohan. Hi and welcome to the show.
Hi Jerome.
Yes, Ashwin, can you tell us when did the fine print come in and when did people realize that what's going to happen as far as lenders, stressed companies and bidders are concerned?
Yeah, so clearly, Jerome, those are the three main stakeholders. The verdict came in last Friday, but the entire IBC or the insolvency and bankruptcy court community has been going through the detailed fine print of the verdict, and that's why we've got Nilang here with us, who is an IBC expert, and he's been dealing with a lot of stressed cases in the past. Nilang, you know, it's been more than 800 days since this entire process got into the insolvency stage, right? It's witnessed innumerable stages of litigation. And finally, we have a verdict from the top court of the land, which is the apex court, the Supreme Court, which has now set aside an earlier order of a lower court, which is a tribunal, and has accepted the bid which was submitted by ArcelorMittal for SR Steel, which was, of course, the company that was undergoing the bankruptcy process. Now, the bid is valued at more than 49,000 crore rupees. And this also paves the way for Lakshmi Mittal's India entry into the Indian steel market. But, you know, there are many key takeaways, Nilang, as you're well aware, because you've read the fine print of the verdict. And that's what we want to drive at, some of the key takeaways and what it means for corporate India as a whole. For starters, why was there so much curiosity about this verdict, Nilang, amongst India Inc.? And why were stakeholders, like Jerome was pointing out earlier, the lenders, the bidders and other stressed companies, why were they all awaiting the fine print of this verdict, and what makes it landmark in that sense? A broader picture, if you could provide to us, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritties.
Sure, no, absolutely. I think a lot of people were very keenly waiting for this because there were very fundamental principles for stressed asset and insolvency resolution, which had been answered sometimes correctly, sometimes incorrectly, and essentially, for the purpose of doing deals, remained unanswered because we didn't have a clear answer. This was, you know, questions relating to distribution amongst creditors, whether personal guarantees are written off, whether a committee of creditors in an IBC process can make a decision, how much a court can interfere in that decision, what the RP's role is or the resolution professional's role is. A lot of these questions were inadequately answered until now. And this judgment now gives a lot of clarity to all these people as to exactly where they stand.
So in that sense, it's a test case.
Well, there have been test cases before, but they haven't answered with so much clarity because they haven't gone all the way to Supreme Court asking these specific questions. Some of these questions have been slightly answered, alluded to, but now the questions have been asked clearly and answered clearly, which is great for the community.
You know, the big clarity that seems to have come in from the Supreme Court verdict, Nilang, and, you know, this is a conclusion that was drawn by the lower court of the tribunal, and that's the order that has now been set aside, which is, in an insolvency process, when there are proceeds that have come in from the resolution of a particular stressed asset, how should they be distributed amongst various categories or classes of creditors? Now, you've got the Supreme Court ruling that operational creditors cannot be treated at par with financial creditors of a bankrupt company. Now, this particular conclusion is very important because the lower court had ruled just the reverse. Help us understand why this distinction is very important in terms of operational creditors versus financial creditors.
If you think about what a bankruptcy or an insolvency resolution code does, it's really the exit mechanism, right? No one wants to think about that exit at the time of entry, but really how you exit is key when you enter, right? When I'm lending to a company, when I'm investing in a company, I want to know if things go wrong, what happens? Ordinarily, what happens is this, which is there's a waterfall and people at the top get more than people at the bottom, or rather people at the top have to be fulfilled before it goes down the waterfall.
So there's a hierarchy.
Which is secured creditors almost always reign supreme, right? Okay. There's a level above that, but they must get the first cut because the way they look at it, they come in the most secured fashion with arguably the lowest return. people down the waterfall know the risk they're taking is a lot more, and therefore they build that into the profit margins or the interest margins, the case may be. For instance, if you're lending secured of someone's gold assets and you're lending unsecured of someone's basically of no assets, then you're going to charge a lot more when you're unsecured than when you're secured to a gold, right? Which has to be factored in. But then when it comes to insolvency, if I tell you, actually, the gold you had security over, not so much. You're going to get the same amount in distribution as the unsecured guy. You're going to go, wait a minute. I came in with a certain expectation 3 years ago. That expectation needs to be maintained. So this is very, very important for the financial community to understand where they stand when things go bad. And they need to have that certainty, which certainty had been taken away from them.
So briefly, there was a lot of controversy because the lower tribunal had held that, you know, operational creditors could be treated at par with financial creditors, and that caused a lot of havoc briefly.
And
so how has this verdict clarified that once and for all?
Yeah. So it's not only operational creditors or trade creditors, but also unsecured creditors. So what they said is this: if the total debt of the company is 500 and 400 comes in, everyone share the 400 pot equally. Where the secured creditors went, wait a minute, but I have security over the entire company's assets, so I should be getting the first cut. Why should I be sharing equally with an unsecured guy or a trade creditor guy? Now, what this judgment now says, no, wait a minute, you have to treat equal people equally, but not unequal people equally.
Right.
So someone who's a trade creditor or an unsecured creditor is not in an equal footing with a secured creditor for obvious reasons. He doesn't have the security. So why would you treat someone unequally equally? And that's what the court has said in short. What it has meant, of course, is that secures come out on top, followed by the waterfall, which you would use in a normal insolvency. Even though, keep in mind, SR didn't go through an insolvency process, which a lot of people think it has. It's gone through an insolvency resolution process. And so what the lower court judge said is, wait a minute, this is not insolvency. I'm not using the insolvency waterfall. I'm not using the pecking order, the hierarchy, because this is not an insolvency. But it's an insolvency resolution, right? There is a lot more money to go past than what the debts are, and therefore someone has to take the hit. Who is that? So what this court says and what the judgment says is the waterfall which you use in insolvency, you can use an insolvency resolution and therefore treat unequals unequally.
But as you correctly pointed out, this is in fact an insolvency resolution, because at the end of the day, there is a resolution plan that was submitted by the winning bidder, Aslam Mittal, and that was what was given the approval by the COC, and that's now been given the stamp of approval by the Supreme Court as well. Right. Now, is there a hierarchy that now has been finally established in terms of dealing with such cases, in terms of distribution of proceeds? What could other live insolvency and bankruptcy cases take from this in terms of lessons?
You mean in terms of decision making?
In terms of decision making, and also in terms of clarity, finally, that these are the rules of the game when it comes to deciding who gets priority and who doesn't.
So the resolution applicant obviously determines how much he wants to pay. So that no one takes away from him. He comes in and says, I'm paying X amount.
That's the bidder, you mean?
The bidder comes in and says, yes, this is what I want to give you. He can, of course, say, this is how I want to distribute it. But what this judgment now says is, no, the COC actually can determine that finally.
Which is the Committee of Creditors, who are the lenders of the bankrupt company.
Perfectly put, correct. So these are the creditors of the company who come and effectively are running the show, because, you know, that's where the control should sit in an IBC process. So this committee actually determines how the resolution happens and how the distribution happens for the amount. What this judgment has also said is, this committee must, of course, keep in mind that whatever it is doing, one, maximizes the value of the company, which is obvious because, you know, we are running short of assets in this process. And two, you're keeping in mind the interest of all stakeholders. Remember, the way the IBC works is a small subset of creditors take decisions for the entire process. So the financial creditors take decisions for the entire company and the stakeholders, which includes trade creditors, which includes shareholders. So you need to keep in mind other stakeholders' interests. Now, what this means, we'll have to wait and watch a little bit, because this is a little bit of uncertainty which remains in the process.
All right.
But short point is, the bidder comes in, gives the amount, the COC determines, he needs to keep in mind the interests of all stakeholders. And finally, the court does not have leeway to mess with this, which is extremely important.
Which is what happened in the low court's order.
Exactly.
When the low court directed that this is the manner in which you should proportionally distribute the money.
Correct.
So essentially, has the Supreme Court now also said that the Committee of Creditors, its commercial wisdom is paramount?
You can't mess with that. Yes, absolutely. What it can do is it can ask the Committee of Creditors, have you considered all the stakeholders' interests? Have you ensured the maximization of value? It can determine whether that's been done. And if the thinking is no, it still can't mess with the COC's wisdom. It has to say, I don't think you met these two parameters. Here's the plan back. Think about it a little more. So all it can do is send it back, but can't tinker with it, which is what the NCLAT and the NCLT did in this judgment at the prior levels.
Which are the two lower courts.
Correct.
Which is what they had done. Correct. Now, what are the lessons here for lenders and bidders, Nilang? And before I move on to that, you know, just to summarize what you have said, when it came to the differences between financial creditors and operational creditors, essentially what you're trying to say is that an SBI, which is a lender or a State Bank of India, cannot be treated at par with a vendor of SR Steel. That's the comparison that you're saying that has now been made clear by the Supreme Court?
Pretty much. So what they're saying is you are SBI, you've come in, you've taken security over the plant and machinery and lent money. You're not similarly situated to a guy who's come in and sold a few bags of coal to the company, right? Because the guy who sold a few bags of coal has a business where he knows what the risks are. He is effectively lending, inverted commas, unsecured. He builds in his profit margins accordingly, right? He is probably not operating on an 8 or 9% profit margin like the banks are, right? Frankly, the banks are not operating on that either. You reduce from their interest rates, cost of capital, and it's a lot less than that. So what it's saying is the both of you are not situated on the same platform and therefore will not be treated similarly.
All right. Now, looking at some of the key takeaways of this verdict for some of the other stakeholders, mainly the bidders. Now, one of the key complaints against the Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code has been that perhaps it has not led to as much resolution, as much successful resolutions as it should have since it has been introduced. There have been some companies that have gone to liquidation. There have been some companies where the litigation is still going on. But the SR Steel verdict from the Supreme Court, what is the biggest takeaway in it or learning from it for bidders? Say, for example, if Jerome is a bidder, he's an MNC bidder, he's come in and he wants to bid for a power company. What are some of the safeguards that Jerome should keep in mind from the SR Steel experience as a bidder?
Well, honestly, I think for a bidder, the greatest thing over here is that he has clarity, or he knows there is clarity in the process once he submits a bid. Until now, bidders in a lot of cases have, you know, heaved a sigh and said, okay, now let's sit on the roller coaster because really it's out of their control. First the COC comes in, then there will be, you know, competing bidders, then there'll be operational creditors or trade creditors coming in arguing. And there, because there wasn't clarity, there's a lot of litigation fighting on distribution. Now what a bidder knows is how the distribution must be done is much, much more clear than it was last Thursday. And it therefore knows that from the point in time it gives a bid to the point in time it gets a company will become much shorter. Because as what used to be was months and months and months of litigation, that should be cut down now because of this judgment. In terms of what a bidder should be worried about and therefore be taking cover, honestly, the only thing I can think of is when they're negotiating with the committee of creditors in terms of distribution, they need to be careful that they are seeing the COC do what this court has said. If they feel the COC is being completely unfair to other stakeholders, is not keeping in their interests into account, is not maximizing value of assets, it knows that this is going to spin into litigation. So, and it, no bidder wants that, right? Because it's sitting while someone else is running the company for months.
That increases the timelines.
Increases timelines, you know. They have capital committed to this process. They don't know when they're going to get the company. Someone else is running their company for many months, not running it the way they want it to be run. So they want to minimize that period. So I think that's the only thing I can think of from a bidder's perspective for now.
Okay. All right. What about from a lender's perspective? A, we clearly now know that lenders have the supreme power of deciding how to decide in terms of the distribution of proceeds.
Correct.
They've been given a blueprint by the Supreme Court as well.
Absolutely.
Right? The key takeaways for lenders or the committee of creditors, the main people to whom the bankrupt company owes money.
I think what is essential for them is keep these two hallmarks in mind, right? The statements made by Supreme Court, ensure maximization of value of the assets of the company and ensure that you're looking after all other stakeholders' interests. Now, if the debt of the company is 5,000 and you only have 1,000 to play with, you're simply not going to be able to give them anything. However, small things like what they did, what Arcelor did in Arcelor in SR Steel, all operational creditors with a debt of less than 1 crore, they got repaid in full. So effectively what they're doing is smaller companies who may find a crore as a large amount to write off in their books, they're paying off. So what a committee of creditors needs to do now is take as much care as possible with the limited assets and monies they have to protect and ensure that the smaller guys do not suffer too big a loss. Even if they pull something out of their pocket, which is what the COC has done or the creditors have done in SR Steel, because all of these measures will help them show to a court that they have kept in mind the interests of the smaller stakeholders and they haven't simply said, sorry, there wasn't enough cash, I'm giving you nothing.
Okay, Nilang, another important aspect from the bidder's point of view is, you know, Say, for example, if I'm a bidder, the first thing I will look at, other than the quality of the asset or the valuation, is, of course, are there any liabilities relating to the bankrupt company? Are there any skeletons in the cupboard that can suddenly come and haunt me later? Yeah. What has the Supreme Court said regarding dealing with these liabilities of a stressed company? And how would they encourage or enthuse bidders going ahead?
I think this is fantastic for bidders, because a big problem with any insolvency resolution process is you buy a company. And during the insolvency resolution, remember, you're always going to have certain claims which are not determined. They're going to be litigations, they're going to be tax claims, where the claims have been made, but the company has said no to the tax authority, I don't owe you 5,000 crores. What does the process do? Does it admit 5,000 crores and pay the claimant a proportionate amount? Does it reject it? The problem for a bidder is, at the end of that process, it wants a clean slate. It wants to know, I've paid X amount and I've got this company and I have no more to pay. But the problem with these uncertain claims was, if you don't know how to resolve them, potentially they could pop up later.
Yes. Right?
And what the judge has called as a hydra head. Mm-hmm. Effectively, what he wants to avoid is a bidder getting nasty shocks after he's bought the company, having thought that he's paid an amount and he's got the company clean.
So he thinks he's paid X, but suddenly X plus Y correct. Happens later on.
Correct.
So how has the Supreme Court resolved that?
What the court has said is, look at these claims.
Okay.
You, the resolution professional, assess the claims, admit it for whatever amount you think is reasonable, and then deal with it. The important thing is deal with it. If the plan, if the process, if the court, if the order deals with a claim, mm-hmm. it's done. Right? It's been written off because 5,000 has been admitted as 100, which the court has said looks fair. 100 has been paid off at 1. The claim is gone. And that's really key for a bidder, because he can point to a court order saying, no, you claimed 5,000, it was admitted at 100, I paid 1 for it, the order said you're extinguished, you can't claim from me anymore.
So therefore, that's a sigh of relief for bidders.
Huge sigh.
Huge sigh. All right. One important aspect which we have not yet discussed is the timeline. So Jerome, you know, one of the cornerstones of the IBC is that if you're a bankrupt company, mm-hmm. then whatever resolution should happen to you, either you get sold to a company or you don't find bidders and you get liquidated, mm-hmm. it should happen within a specified timeline. And in many of these insolvency and bankruptcy court cases, Jerome, the timelines were getting unnecessarily extended.
Right.
So there was a lot of litigation on that as well. Now, Nilang, correct me if I'm wrong, but the union cabinet has suggested a 330-day period, correct? Saying that, listen, there has to be deadline. It can't keep going on till time immemorial, because that doesn't serve the interest of any stakeholders. But the Supreme Court has said that 330-day period is not mandatory, meaning if required in a particular case, the court can also wish to extend it. How does this sort of solve the problem of, you know, resolving these cases within a specified timeline? Don't you think that opens the window for cases to go on for a really long time?
Yeah, no, I agree it does. But why did we do this, right? I mean, this is a remarkably short timeline, 270, 330. 330 days was supposed to include all litigation on a case. I mean, remember, we are a jurisdiction where an insolvency process took 6-7 years. I think our average, as per some World Bank report, was 7 years. The Bankruptcy Law Reform Committee, which is the committee set up by the government to rethink Indian insolvency laws, said, listen, this is the key issue. Right? If you're going to take 7 years to resolve stress in a company, those 7 years are going to whittle off the assets and you're going to get nothing, which is why recoveries were, you know, 10, 15 cents to the dollar. And therefore, a huge swing of the pendulum under IBC, and the law says everything be done 9 months. 9 months is faster than any other jurisdiction in the world.
So we are the jurisdiction or the country with the least amount of time under which an IBC case should be solved.
As mandated by law, yes.
Wow.
No other jurisdiction says anywhere in the world finish in 9 months. So
wow.
This is a dramatic change from where we used to be. I think the makers realized it was an ideal and that there would be extensions, and there have been extensions, but not by much. I mean, if you look at the percentages, I think a huge chunk are still getting resolved in a year.
Okay.
Now, still.
But why has the Supreme Court said it's not mandatory? What's the thinking behind it?
A whole bunch were going beyond a year.
Okay.
As you said, you know, took 2 years. For
yeah.
very good reasons, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a test case, a huge case, powerful promoters, significant legal issues,
yeah.
and a whole bunch of issues have been resolved in the process. Now, what the parliament said, this is taking too long. We wanted 9 months, but there's a lot of litigation going on. Litigation is getting stretched out. Let's now say, 330 days is all you can take, including litigation. What the Supreme Court has said is, that doesn't work. I mean, litigation, if there's a fundamental issue, is a fundamental right. It's a constitutional right. You can't take that away by saying 60 days or else liquidation. So what they've said is, it's very important for the timeline to be maintained. 330 days should be maintained. However, it is not going to be mandatory, i.e., if you miss it, you don't go into liquidation.
Okay.
If you miss it, it's a problem. It should be addressed. It's not good. Let's figure out why.
So who decides how long it can be stretched to? The courts?
The courts.
Okay. So that discretion has been given to the courts.
Now, whether that's a long rope, short rope, we'll find out.
All right. So, Nilang, clearly, if you look at the key takeaways, commercial wisdom of the lenders of a bankrupt company, that should be respected. That's a big one, because courts were dictating in certain cases how you should distribute the proceeds, right? That's a big one. If you look at the treatment of financial creditors and operational creditors, secured creditors and unsecured creditors, the Supreme Court has clearly laid down that they can't be treated at par. And Nilang has very succinctly explained why. And finally, bidders are now today, Jerome, in a more secure position. They have more clarity, they have more security, and therefore perhaps they'll be more enthused to bid because there's lesser uncertainty.
Right.
So those are the key takeaways, Jerome. It's back to you.
All right. So that was Nilang Desai, partner at law firm AZB and Partners, and Money Control's deputy editor Deals, Ashwin Mohan, giving you the fine print of the Supreme Court verdict in the SR Steel case.
And now a word on our subscription product. Money Control Pro offers actionable investment ideas, independent research, insights and analysis from the world of business, economy, politics and policy. Get access to Money Control Pro at ₹599 for a year. Use code GETPRO. For more information, check out the Money Control website or mobile app. The offer is available on Android and the web.
With that, I wrap this special episode. In case you have any query or in case you want to give any feedback, please do write to us on mcpodcast@nw18.com. I repeat, that's mcpodcast@nw18.com. For more news, views and updates, stay logged on to Money Control. Thank you for listening.